This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. Good to see you all. And welcome to the Sam and Rose Stein Institute for Research on Aging's monthly public lecture series. For those of you I haven't had the chance to meet yet, my name is Danielle Glorioso, and I'm the Director of Research and Development at the Stein Institute. At the Stein Institute, we're committed to advancing lifelong health and well-being through training, research, and community outreach. This public lecture series is an example of our community outreach programs. And for some of you, you've been attending these public lectures for over 20 years now. And these public lectures have been free to the public through generous donations from all of you. So we'd like to thank you so much for your contributions through the years to the Stein Institute. For more information about the Stein Institute, you can find us online at aging.ucsd.edu. We are very excited about our speaker tonight. This is always a very exciting topic. We have Dr. Heather Hofflick here tonight. She's an assistant clinical professor of medicine here at UCSD. She is involved in training medical students and residents here at UCSD and has special interests in osteoporosis, thyroid, diabetes management, and women's health. And she was also voted in 2012 and 2003 as a top doc in San Diego Magazine. So we're very excited to have her tonight. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Hofflick.
Thank you, everyone, and I'm glad to be back here again and speak on and give you an osteoporosis update for the year of 2014 and go over some of the facts about osteoporosis diagnoses and different controversies, and hopefully give you more information about osteoporosis in general. So the definition of osteoporosis is impaired bone strength, low bone mineral density, poor bone quality, leading to impaired bone strength and increased fracture risk due to this bone loss. So here you can see a normal bone and the changes that can occur with osteoporotic bone, how it's thinned out and makes the bone weaker and more susceptible to fracture. And there are many things that lead to this just besides the bone density in the test that some of you receive, and that's bone quality with turnover stress damage and issues with mineralization. So there's a lot more just than the bone density that we are aware of that can lead to overall bone strength. So I just want to highlight, I always love this slide because it highlights how many more hip fractures and fractures there are than actually heart attacks, stroke, breast cancer, which are all serious diseases as well. But it's important to note that having a hip fracture can also increase the risk for mortality, morbidity, and death, because when you have a hip fracture from a fall, you can end up in the hospital and things often occur. So there's a lot of these that occur, and we need to do everything we can to prevent these hip fractures. So just an example, when we talk about fractures, in this is the area of the hip that they look at, and to see the fractures in the bone, they see an increased area. And in when we talk about vertebral fractures or spine fractures, what we're talking about is a compression of your actual vertebrae. So it actually gets smaller, and that's why sometimes your height decreases. So when you hear about these spine compression fractures, that's actually what's happening. The bone is actually becoming compressed. So how do we diagnose osteoporosis? So this is what a bone density machine looks like. Many of you have probably seen this or had one done. And this is something that measures two areas. It measures the bone mineral content over the area. And when you go to your doctor for a report, it gives us a scoring system. So many of you have probably grappled with these T-scores and Z-scores and have heard these over the years. But this is currently how we do give the definition of osteoporosis in a patient. So if you have a, so when you get this bone density report back from your doctor, if your T-score is minus 2.5 or lower, that is osteoporosis. Your T-score compares you, the bone mineral density, to a young normal adult of the same sex around age, 30. The T-score, when you have a fragility fracture, if a doctor says to you you've had a spontaneous fracture, something that was low trauma, you didn't really fall hard or fall from, you know, if you just fell from standing height or just stepped off a curve, this also qualifies for the definition of osteoporosis. So even if your bone report comes back with just a little bit of bone loss and not osteoporosis, still having this kind of fracture denotes that you do have osteoporosis. Now, T-scores between minus 1 and minus 2.5 is something called osteopenia, or low bone mass, and something less than minus 1 or above minus 1, and greater is normal bone density. So this is the way that we characterize. Now, in patients less than age 50, we actually do not use a T-score, but we use something called a Z-score. And this is a bone mineral density compared to a young adult of the same age and sex. And the only thing, we don't actually use the terms osteoporosis or osteopenia in the age less than 50. We use the term low bone mass, and we use the Z-scores, not the T-scores. So who should have this bone mineral density test? Well, that's changed. So we always knew women age greater than 65, but now also it's very important that men age 70 years or older, while some of the guidelines haven't clarified that, the National Osteoporosis Foundation, other societies do recommend that. I recommend that for my patients, that a male age greater than 70 have a bone mineral density test. Men are just as much as risk, if not have a greater risk and more numbers of hip fractures in the older ages, so it's very important too. Anyone with risk factors, which I'll get to soon, age 50 to 69, and anybody with a fracture over the age of 50, that's something that we're trying to work on and identify now, that if patients have a wrist fracture or a foot fracture, we do, over the age of 50, we do want to make sure they have a bone mineral density scan, because we may be identifying earlier cases of osteoporosis. So any type of fracture over the age 50, definitely I would recommend a bone mineral density scan. So one of the questions I get asked often in the clinic is, how often should I have a bone density scan? So this is very controversial right now, when and how, and there's many different studies. But I will say, number one, when you do have a bone density scan, it's important to have it on the same machine, and brand is preferable, and so the same location. That's because they're standardized to that location, and different brands have different, while it's the same scoring system, sometimes the way they're calibrated can be different. So that is important when we check bone density. Medicare does allow for every 2 years now, and they are going to be more strict with that in the coming years, that you can have one every 2 years. Of course, if you're on treatment, sometimes we do closer follow-up, and your physician might recommend every year after you start a therapy. But definitely, we don't check less than 1 year for bone densities. And then recent studies have shown that even with osteopenia, people that just maybe perhaps at younger age, you can wait even 5 years or longer. So I think there's a lot of controversy right now about this topic, when to repeat, and I suggest talking to your physician about how often you should have it is important. So one other thing that I just wanted to highlight that you should talk to your physician about is that there's many different reasons that people may have bone loss and osteoporosis. And this is one of my favorite topics, because I'm very interested in seeing, you know, and learning more about why people have the bone loss that they do. So as you can see, this list is enormous, just to show you a lot of things and reasons. But in general, a lot of physicians recommend lab tests. So I just want to highlight this here, that, you know, going to your physician if you have it and suggesting that you have a workup for other causes. So for example, in men, we know that low testosterone levels can lead to bone loss, just as when women reach menopause, when their estrogen declines, they are at higher risk for bone loss, as estrogen and the hormones promote bone growth. So vitamin D, very important. I think in the last 4 years, we've checked and have been checked for vitamin D. Also, you know, just a blood count, a metabolic panel for liver tests. And there are studies to show that sometimes people lose calcium in their urine. And so sometimes the kidneys don't work as they should to bring the calcium and keep it in our body. So we do recommend, that was actually found in one study to be one of the most common reasons that people have bone loss, and that's a 24-hour urine calcium, a creatinine, that many groups recommend be checked. These other tests over here are sometimes, so I would say the ones up to the testosterone are, you know, common tests that I would recommend checking. However, sometimes specifically depending on findings, one secondary cause is something called multiple myeloma, a type of cancer. So I often check what's called an SPEP, which is a blood test and a urine test that can look for this type of cancer that's associated with fractures. Celiac, gluten sensitivities, things like that we've all have become more common can lead to bone loss and thinning. So that's something that your physician may want to consider having testing if you have symptoms. Phosphorus is something, low phosphorus can be associated with different types leading to bone loss, and magnesium. And sometimes if the calcium is elevated, there is a condition called hyperparathyroid where your body secretes a hormone that can lead to bone loss. So these are some of the tests that I typically will run when I see somebody with bone loss or more importantly, unexpected bone loss for age or fractures. So the next question that always comes up, well, how do we decide who we treat? And I just want to highlight that we used to follow these guidelines by many of the societies, the National Osteoporosis Foundation, the Menopause Group, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, and we used to just treat based on that T-score that you got when you get your bone density scan. We used to say, oh, everyone with a -2, or, you know, if you're 50 and you have this osteopenia, you go on a medication. Well, and so everyone just based on a number. But now what we're doing is we really want to know who do we treat. We know high risk, where the T-score is low, we do treat. But what do we do about this intermediate group of this of ranges of T-scores? And we know that while your fracture, the number of fractures goes up as your T-score goes lower, we also know that, the rate, there's still a lot of fractures in the osteopenic group, even though the fracture rate is higher when you're osteoporosis, there's still a lot of fractures when your T-score might be in what we call the osteopenic range. So we know that age is a risk for fracture. You're more likely to fracture at the same T-score, bone density score, when you're older. You have a higher 24% risk of fracture versus when you're younger. And we also know that the prior having a prior fracture increases your risk for fracture. So somebody with the same age, same T-score, but had a prior fracture, their absolute fracture risk goes up. So 22% versus 12. So what happened is in 2008, we started using this fracture risk assessment tool. It's called that was put out by the World Health Organization. So I use this very often in my clinic. When a patient comes in with their bone density test, I go here on the computer and I use their ethnicity and, depending on what country they're from or, United States, and I fill out this questionnaire based on questions that I ask them and risk factors. So age, I fill in as a risk factor, their sex, male or female, and then we know that weight and height is a risk. Weight is a risk factor. So and BMI. So weight less than 57.6 kilograms. So being less than about one in the mid 120s is a risk factor for osteoporosis. Having had a previous fragility fracture. This is not a major traumatic fracture, but something that, like I said before, just stepping off a curb or even spontaneously fracture. You can check yes for a previous fracture. If your parent fractured their hip, that is a risk factor for you having osteoporosis because there is genetics associated with this. Smoking, we know, definitely increases your risk for having fracture and bone loss. Steroids, anyone on chronic steroids is at risk for fractures. And rheumatoid arthritis, having rheumatoid arthritis is independently associated with fracture loss. And then any other causes of vitamin D deficiency, a testosterone deficiency, put you at risk. And alcohol, greater than 3 glasses of a medium-sized glass of wine daily, or any kind of beer, greater than 3 glasses, puts you at risk and does hurt the bones. So this is a scoring system. So I go through with my patients and I try to assess their risk factors. And then I use their bone density score to help determine what their risk is. So this shows you an average 70-year-old patient. Now, in this scoring system, you only can use your hip, your femoral neck, or your hip score. We actually don't use the spine score for various reasons. This actually, when you click on the box, it gives you your 10-year risk of fracture and of having a fracture. And so basically, I can give my patient a fair estimate of whether or not they're likely to develop a fracture, and this leads to, do you need treatment? And so this is something that I really recommend having done if you're in that osteopenic range, not with osteoporosis, but in that range where there is some mild bone loss. So in this patient, so we used to treat people just by this T-score of -2. And so you can see now I take a 70-year-old with the -2 and I calculate her risk. And actually her risk for any major osteoporotic fracture, her 10-year risk is less than 20%. And this risk for hip fracture is less than 3%. So actually, this patient would not, I may not treat. I mean, there are other risk factors to take into consideration, and I look at the whole picture. But based on those guidelines, I may not treat her. So you can see here, if your scores are between these numbers, and if your 10-year probability when your doctor calculates that is greater than 3% for a hip fracture or 20%, then we now say treatment is indicated. So this gives us a better scoring system. We're now treating older patients with lower scores treatment, but we are not treating our younger patients with -2, with lower scores. So we're not using the score. We may not treat someone, sometimes even a -2.5, just hitting the osteoporosis in the hip. But if they're 60 years old, I will do other prevention and different things, but I may not put them on these medications. Their risk is still lower at a young age. The average age of hip fractures is, you know, in your 80s, 82. So, you know, when you're 60, there may be more prevention that we can work on besides going to a bisphosphonate or other medication. So this is an important scoring system that I encourage you to discuss with your physician. And this scoring system is really only intended for postmenopausal women and men age 50 and older. It actually applies mostly to people who are not on treatment already. So that is something because it can be falsely elevated. And you must use the hip score, not the spine score. And once again, this is only a guideline, but it is much better guidelines than what we've had to work with these bone density scans in the past. So sometimes I may get a low score, but I look at other factors that may be going on with the patient, and I may need to treat them anyway. For instance, if they're on prednisone, which is a steroid, for a long period of time, I may decide to treat by different guidelines. So once again, this is only a guideline. So now I'll dive into some of the therapies. So that's basically how we diagnose, things we think about in the clinic. And now, what are some things that we can do? So first of all, I always try to think preventatively, non-pharmacological approaches. So definitely adequate intake of dietary calcium and vitamin D, regular physical activity, minimize alcohol intake, and encourage smoking cessation if someone's smoking. And I always think minimize risk of fall. So let me talk about each of these things more in depth. So one thing is your mom always told you to drink milk, and she was right, because milk is, and calcium in the diet is very important. So currently the calcium recommendations by the Institute of Medicine, which I follow, is 1,200 milligrams daily for women older than 50, 1,000 milligrams daily for men older than 50, and 1,200 milligrams for men over the age of 70. So, and one of our new thinkings is to try to obtain your calcium through the diet first and then supplement. So that's something that we discuss in visits. And so why is this? Well, back in 2010, there was a meta-analysis that showed a possible association between heart attacks and too much calcium intake in the diet. So these were on patients that were taking greater than 1,500 milligrams of calcium daily, plus possibly a lot in their diet too. So this kind of had us, you know, step back a little bit and say, wow, you know, if someone's on 1,500 milligrams of calcium supplement and then they're taking that much in their diet, well, they might be getting too much calcium. It might go to the coronary arteries and you know, thus lead to heart attacks. However, there have been some recent follow-up studies that have actually showed the opposite. So, that being, as they always do, right? So I think until that said, I always play it safe, and I actually have my patients go home, I give them this calculator, and I say, assess the calcium in your diet. If you are getting 1,200, then you don't need a calcium supplement. If you are getting about, you know, some people have lower calcium diets, so 600, 800, we'll take one calcium supplement to be safe. So I might have them take a 500 or 600 calcium supplement. But I always try to get them to calculate. So this is something that I will get to you through email. But so automatically when you calculate your calcium in your diet, you get an automatic 250 to start at the start of each day from all food sources. And then if you look on your container of milk, it'll always say for the daily intake, it'll have 25% or 30%. And so that equals typically 300 milligrams of calcium, depending on the percentage. So let's say it says 30%. That equals 300 milligrams. So if you have an 8-ounce glass of milk. Now, you have to be careful with serving size and portions, and I'll give you a handout that will explain more. But basically, so if you have a glass of milk and you have one yogurt, now be careful because Greek yogurt, I want everyone to be careful, does not have as much calcium as regular yogurt. So that's something important to look at. I actually had mine the other day from Whole Foods and I saw that it only had 100 milligrams compared to sometimes the 250 or 300 in the regular. Now it has more protein, but it has some less calcium, so be aware of that. And then, you know, some cheese. So if you're getting a glass of milk, a yogurt, and some cheese, you're already there at 800 plus the 250. You're already at 1,050, you know, a day. So you're pretty close to 1,200. And then, of course, greens and different vegetables, I'll give you a handout, add to that as well. So there, you know, someone that can get it through their diet, and that's what we're really encouraging. There's also, don't forget, fortified foods such as fortified orange juice is a very good source of calcium. And so breads are fortified, so that's very good as well. And so we encourage you to try and get the 1,200 milligrams through the diet if you can. And if not, it's very safe and reasonable to supplement as well. It's just we want to make sure people don't get too much. So another question I'm commonly asked almost every day is, what type of calcium should I take? So there's so many calciums out there when you go to the food stores. So really, there have not been any good studies showing that one is necessarily better than the other, and that means, you know, chews. So I put up here calcium chews versus a pill versus the chocolate Viactives, and also the different types. So there's calcium carbonate, calcium citrate, calcium phosphate, but there are some important rules, and that is if you take calcium carbonate, it does need to be taken with food and spread out during the day for best absorption, whereas calcium citrate, the one that's very popular at Costco, does not need to be taken with food. So if someone asks me which one to take, I really have no specific recommendations on the type that you take. But if you're someone that might forget or take it after, don't want to worry about taking it with a meal, I would recommend calcium citrate. Also, people that are on proton pump inhibitors, such as Prilosec for reflux, you may want to consider calcium citrate because it can be taken, you know, throughout the day and not with meals, and might be better for absorption. So there are some variations, but mostly just following those rules is good. And some people take gummies, they don't like to take the pills. So I'm happy if you need a supplement to take it in any form that you can. There's also liquid calcium as well. And vitamin D is another important nutrient that we say. So vitamin D is very hard to get through food. You can get it through the sun, but also we know from our dermatologists here that we also need to avoid the sun with our sunscreen. So to get enough vitamin D, I do recommend a supplement. It is added to some milk and orange juice sources, and I'll give you handouts that show you some of the food sources, but I do think a supplement is wise when it comes to vitamin D. And you should also can have your level checked, and if it is adequate, you may not need it. But most people, it does seem, need a supplement. So we do recommend 800 to 1,000 IUs daily. And the maximum, and I follow with the Institute of Medicine guidelines, the maximum dose recommended is 4,000 IUs daily currently at this time. There's a lot of controversy with vitamin D. A lot of patients will ask, well, what level should I be at? And I think right now at this time, there is no set level, but I do recommend being at least over 30. Now, the Institute of Medicine does say greater than 20, but I think at this time, most expert opinions say over 30. Now, you will hear some people out there aim for a goal of 50. You might have heard that. And I think while that may be okay, I'm not aware of as much evidence to aim for that goal. So I think that's fine to be in the 30 to 50 range, maybe higher, but I don't think we have enough evidence just yet. I think recently, so as you know, calcium and vitamin D have been shown in many studies to increase bone mineral density, but have never been shown to prevent fractures. And I still think it's important because there has been some recent studies published this year that just came out in the news that weren't sure if they even increased bone mineral density. And I think that's also controversial, but I still recommend taking it. I think it's important to get the supplement. I think hopefully we'll be learning more and more about this. There's also been no studies to show any associations with cardiovascular disease or reduction in breast cancer, but there has been some recent studies on this. You know, some say yes, some say no. So right now, I think it's important for bone density, but I'm more cautious and say more conservative because, you know, I will have some people come in that take a lot of vitamin D, and sometimes I've had levels come back over the hundreds, and I think it's important to be more in that 30 to safely 60, 70 range, you know, as a range and not to go overboard. The maximum limit of vitamin D to be taken daily is 10,000 IUs, studies have shown, in daily. Over that is associated with increased side effects, but I would say I would not recommend, unless in certain clinical situations, there are people that need 5,000 a day or higher for different medical reasons, but in the average patient, typically I give between 1,000 to 2,000 IUs daily, I would say, is my max, is about 2,000. I think people get to adequate vitamin D in that range. I have many patients who take 4,000 and 5,000 too and do great on that too. So, you know, but for me, 1,000 to 2,000 is my current recommendation. So I encourage you to discuss with your doctor and your individual needs. So exercise is very important. We know that you need to exercise for your bones. So, and we know that you need to do weight-bearing exercises. So the important thing is to find out which exercise is right for you. So you could, low-impact exercise is great. Walking, elliptical, low-impact aerobics is great, and running, jogging, jumping rope. The point is to do for 30 minutes a day, 5 to 7 days a week is the best to stimulate the bone to rebuild new bone. And exercise has been shown to increase bone mineral density by 1 to 2%. The exercises that are not good, I see a lot of swimmers, surfers, bikers, a lot of male bikers and female bikers that are not walking. They're on their bike all the time, and they are not walking and putting the weight of their body on their bones. They're not, you know, lifting weights. And while it's great exercise, I encourage you to swim and bike. I also encourage you, if you are going to do that, to get out and walk a little bit too, or run or do the elliptical. So try and do that. I encourage that. Other good exercises, it's very important to do your weight resistance against gravity. And so lifting weights, machine or free weights, exercise, yoga and Pilates is currently being studied as a good method for balance strength training. Whether or not it increases bone mineral density remains to be determined, but I encourage it because as you age, balance is a very important thing and resistance training. So I encourage you to do these exercises as well. Another important thing is fall prevention and to make sure that your home is very safe because falls lead to fractures. So using handrails, keep floors clutter-free, clean, use rubber mats, good lighting in all the rooms is very, very important. So definitely take a look around your home, discuss with your physician to make sure that your home is very safe. These are all very good sources of preventions for falls. So one question, I just added this slide, that people ask in terms of diet is, what about caffeine? I get asked that often. And we know that in the Rancho Bernardo study, that coffee, they actually looked at that about coffee and bone density, and it was actually not found in smaller quantities to hurt the bones. So, and you know, it's very important. I do recommend adding a little calcium to your coffee, as long as you're getting adequate calcium. Coffee has not been shown in, you know, small doses, less than 3 glasses a day, to hurt the bones or the bone density. And tea, in the same way, there's no evidence to say that it hurts the bones. So we do encourage small amounts of caffeine, as long as you're getting adequate calcium. Now, soda is a different story. I tell my patients, you know, I have a lot of people who come in and say they drink 1 liter a day, or they've been drinking 4 cans. And I think it's very important. Cola is actually specifically cola, because a lot of people ask about seltzer water and different things. But cola, a tough study did show that phosphoric acid in these sodas can cause significant bone loss in these studies. And that was at greater than 3 sodas a day. But I do think it's important to think about that. And so one area I do say, if you can cut back on your soda as a caffeine source, to try and do that. But more information and studies are being looked at that. And one other thing I want to mention, sodium. A low sodium diet, sodium can hurt the bones as well. So low sodium diets are very important, as they're also good for heart health, hypertension, and other areas of chronic disease. A lot of people ask me about vitamin K, magnesium, phosphorus. Do I need to be on supplements such as these? And I just think, you know, eat a very healthy, well-rounded diet. Eat a very healthy, well-rounded diet is most important. In general, with lots of fruits and vegetables. Supplements, vitamin K, phosphorus, magnesium have not been shown to reduce the fracture risk or be associated with bone mineral density at this point. I mean, there are some that are still looking into this, and so we have a lot more to learn about that. But at this point, we don't recommend taking those supplements, and I encourage you to get food sources that might have those nutrients as well. So, in general, I just want to talk about some of the therapies. I know I'm giving a lot of information today, but I at least want to touch on a little bit of everything, and then that way you can go back to your own physician with some questions that you may have and to dive into more of these topics in detail. So we talked about lifestyle and different changes that you can make today, but we do have a group of FDA-approved therapies, and I just want to touch on each of these briefly to give you some knowledge of these. So the objectives of our treatments for osteoporosis is basically, in osteoporosis, you have two types of bone cells in general, the osteoblasts, which stimulate formation of new bone and build bone, and then you have these osteoclasts, which break down the bone. But they're all interconnected, because you actually need your bone breakdown cells to help signal and build bone cells. So they're all, it's a very woven network, which we're still learning more and more about. So in most of our treatments now, we stop the bone breakdown cells, and we only have one treatment which actually works on the bone buildup, the osteoblasts, to build back bone. And so that's the basic mechanisms of most of ours. So I know we've heard a lot in the media and the news in the last few years about these, but I do want to still say there are lots of benefits of osteoporosis therapy. They do reduce our fracture risk. They do reduce disability and pain, not in the sense that they do, but they help prevent fractures, thereby reducing pain. They can preserve the independence by reducing fractures, reduce height loss, and have, hopefully, by reducing hip fractures, a positive effect on mortality, and by preventing this, and a positive effect on our bone mineral density. So there are many reasons that if your doctor recommends it, it may be wise to take one of these medications. So bisphosphonates, which many of you have heard and are as the name of Fosamax or Actonel or reclass therapies, zoledronic acid, work by inhibiting the osteoclast, the breakdown of bone. And there are some side effects with the oral medications. There can be reflux, or what's known as esophagitis, kidney damage, but that's more if you already have reduced kidney function. And it does come in oral, and now there is that once yearly intravenous infusion of where it goes straight to the bones and it bypasses the oral system. So these are very good medications that can help. But it did come up in the media in recent years that they may cause these fractures when given over the long term. So most people here probably have heard about these atypical femur fractures that are associated with long-term use, that's in greater than 10 years on these. And back in 2008, 2009, I was seeing some of these. These are still very, very rare. They actually look like this. And so they're fractures that are basically look like a beak almost, or a spike that occur in the femoral shaft area. And so I did see, I would say, more of these a few years ago, because when I was first seeing patients here at UCSD, I had a lot of patients that came to me on 20 years. I had 15, 20 years of therapy on these medications. And we now realize that perhaps that's too long, because what's happening is they're, you know, slowing the burn. So normal bone turns over, those cells that I showed you that build up and form bone, and then they break down. But as you're on these for many years, your bone isn't remodeling or turning over, and then that could potentially lead to these breaks in the bone. And so that is one of the theories. Now, these still are very rare, but I present this in that it's just more the timing. I think these are very good medicines when used for the correct amount of time. So I put up this slide just in general to, and I know it's probably hard to see from back there, but basically I try to follow this by one of my colleagues, Dr. Nelson Watts. And basically, this is just a guideline, but for anyone at high risk for fracture, I will treat for 10 years, and then I will do what's called a drug holiday, where I take them off the medication and we watch. And then same with if, you know, you're lower risk, I might treat for 5 years and or 5 to 10 in risk. And I just encourage you, if you're on one of these medications or you're thinking about, just to talk to your doctor to see how long you should be on them. But I want to show you that they are great medicines when used at the right time. You could see that this is one of the trials where they had patients put on this medicine, alendronate, Fosamax, and at 5 years they took one group off the medicine and they kept the yellow line, stayed on the Fosamax till 10 years. And you can see that even taking a holiday or a leave of absence from this medication, your fracture risk does go up again. This is the fracture risk, but you're still protected even in these first couple years. So the point is that you can take a break from the medication without having, and it still remains and it's still working. And so we've proven that through some of these trials. Also, I want to say that they're very good drugs because you could see with many of these that they start working within the first 6 months. You can see the difference that the fracture risk really does go down within the first 6 months. And then with our new intravenous medicine, the fracture risk goes down over time. And out to 3 years was the big trial where they showed a 77% reduction in spine fractures. And in most of these medications with these bisphosphonates, we saw a nice 50% reduction in fractures. So they do work well. I always recommend them, you know, in higher risk patients or at patients at the right time in your 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, when there is more of a risk for fractures. These are wonderful medications that do work well in the right population. And it's something you should definitely, you know, discuss with your physician. Another thing that I commonly get asked is, well, my bone mineral density scores didn't change. Does that mean that my drug isn't working or my medication isn't working? And I just want to show you that actually this graph just to kind of highlights, even if you have a, you know, no change in your bone density or an increase, you still have a low fracture risk. And so you can see here, even if there is no change in your bone density, this is showing you on these medicines, it's still a good thing. And that means that it is still working even if you don't see these significant increases. So another medication I wanted to discuss is something called teriparatide or Forteo injections. This is a medication that we reserve for higher risk patients, and this is our bone builder. So this is the one that stimulates our osteoblasts, our bone formation cells, and works through a hormone that we all produce in the body that when given daily, it actually works to increase the bone growth. So it's indicated for people with maybe a fragility fracture, with severe bone loss. And it's a pen that you give once daily. It's actually an injection that you give yourself in your abdomen, in your thigh. And the duration of this therapy is up to 2 years. And it did have a nice effect and reduced fractures. It also builds back bone. And there are some side effects. But the one thing I note with this bone builder is that there is a black box warning that it did cause bone cancer, osteosarcoma, when given to rats after 2 years. That being said, we can now safely say this medication has been out for over 10 years. So this is the warning on the box, but it's been out now for over 10 years, and they do large case reports when people are on this medication, and they have not found one case of cancer in the registry above the risk of the normal population. So this is a very wonderful medication to help build back the bones, and there are some contraindications, but it is a good medication. So it does increase bone mineral density, it increases in the spine, but we only use this medication for 2 years, and then you have to follow that up with something else to maintain the effects, studies have shown. I do want to say that with all these medications, there's no evidence to say that one is better than the other. So even though this one seems like it could be the best because it's actually stimulating and building back your spine, studies have not, we don't know if the fracture reduction, the endpoints, is actually better. And I just want to touch on another medicine that I actually have been using more now that we're using bisphosphonates in a younger population less. So this is something that I tend to use in a younger population of patients. It's called raloxifene or Evista. It is now, it used to be called a SERM, a serum estrogen receptor modulator. It's now called an estrogen agonist antagonist. So let me explain what that means. It actually works. Its sister drug, which you may have heard of that works a little differently, is tamoxifen that's used for breast cancer. This medicine is actually used for patients that are high risk for breast cancer. It actually prevents breast cancer. It's not given to patients with breast cancer. It's given to people with the genes for breast cancer. So it actually works and antagonizes estrogen at the level of the breast. But it stimulates at the estrogen receptors at the level of the bone and actually increases bone density. So it does reduce fractures, but only in the spine. This is a treatment specifically for females. And so basically, it works great in reducing the rate of fractures and increasing bone mineral density. But it did not work in the trials. You can see here it started to look good, but at the end of 3 years, it didn't work versus placebo in preventing hip fractures. So I can use this in a younger population that might have severe osteoporosis in the spine, but with the hip bone density, if somebody has it there, I might consider another option. There are some side effects in this. It does increase your risk for blood clots, hot flashes, and in some studies in high-risk populations, it did slightly increase the risk of stroke. And so I do tend to use this more in my 50 to 70 population, whereas I am more wary about using it in an older population just for that reason. But I still have a lot of patients on it into their 90s, and it does work well. So this is what I like about this medicine is that it's another alternative instead of using bisphosphonates. Now, this is something that we can use, and it's not for everyone. The other added bonus is that you do get the breast cancer reduction while you're on it, if you're on it for the bones. So it does have dual purposes, so it is a good medication. I was just at a conference last week, and this is one of the newer medicines they're looking at. I haven't used this yet, but there now has been approved a conjugated estrogen along with one of these type of medicines that called bazodoxifene, which is like raloxifene. And so one of the thoughts with this medication is that along with estrogen, it can prevent hot flashes. It hasn't been shown to have any effects on the breast because you're using it along with the medicine that's an anti-breast agent. So there are some other options along with estrogen. Now, we all know estrogen we used to use for osteoporosis, I mentioned here, but is no longer FDA approved for osteoporosis prevention or treatment. We use it solely for someone with hot flashes that may have that, but there is no indication solely for osteoporosis. We also know that after you use estrogen, when you stop it, you lose all the effects on the bones, the bone density declines. So this no longer do we use estrogen as a specific treatment. And so another medicine that is newer since 2010 is denosumab, or Prolia. You may have seen the commercials with Blythe Danner, Gwyneth Paltrow's mother. And so this is a human monoclonal antibody. It binds to RANK ligand and prevents it. So it works in another pathway that inhibits the breakdown of bone. And so this is an injection, like a vaccine, that you get twice yearly. And that's what it looks like when you get it. So it works in a different pathway. And basically, this is another medication that we have now that really prevents the risk of fractures, hip fractures overall. But there are some side effects to it. They saw a lot of skin and tissue reactions in the study, and it could possibly cause some oversuppression of the bone as well. Possibly these atypical fractures were seen later on in post-marketing reports. But once again, I've been using this now. I was conservative with it at first, but I think that it's been a great medicine. It does not accumulate in the bone the way that the bisphosphonates, the Fosamax, does. And so when you stop the medication, the effect does go away. It also does not need to be dose adjusted. So in patients with kidney function, it does not hurt the kidney at all. So it's somebody with a lower kidney function can use this medication. The other good thing, and then some disadvantages are that it may cause some bone suppression, and there were some skin infections in the studies and side effects. But I would say that this medication is wonderful in that it's really showing nicely in the studies to increase spinal bone density. There's still a lot of questions that remain for me as a clinician. I don't know how long to continue this treatment for, and so we have now 8 to 10 years of studies, but one of my concerns is that if you stop the medication, will you lose everything quickly, and how do we maintain its effects? My other question with this medication is that if I have someone that was on Fosamax or the bisphosphonates for, over 10 years, am I going to switch to this other medication right away that might also decrease the bone turnover? So there are a lot of questions out there, but I think it's a wonderful medication when used in the right time and place also. I've seen patients do very nicely on it. I haven't had any side effects, yet over the past few years in my patients, and but there's been some reports along the way, and people have done nicely and have had nice increases in bone density. So I think we have a lot to learn about this medicine, but it is another option. So I'll just finish up at the conference I was just at, the big osteoporosis conference. There are two new therapies on the way, and we have, worked on a trial with Dr. Elizabeth Barrett-Connor here at UCSD for odonocaptib, which really in the trials looks like a very wonderful drug. It works by a new mechanism, different from the others that we have, and patients did increase their bone density nicely in the trials. It's still awaiting FDA approval. I actually just Googled it yesterday to see where they're at, but we're not there yet. So it is awaiting FDA approval right now, but the trials have been completed, the 5-year trials. And then this year in the New England Journal of Medicine, there's a medicine called, I'm still learning how to pronounce this, but romosozumab, which works by another new mechanism and an anti-sclerostin antibody inhibitor, which is another way in one of the bone pathways. And this medication looks very promising as a new bone builder. It's an injection that's given twice a year that actually builds back the bone the way that daily injection that I talked about Forteo does. So, this is still a ways off, but it had some exciting promise in the early trials. So hopefully down the road we'll have some new therapies and hopefully some new bone building therapies that we can work with. So in general, I know I talked about a lot of information, but I at least wanted to touch on some things. Now, I know a lot of people wanted some more information on diet and nutrition, and I will say that I do run a bone health and education group, and I get speakers at UCSD. We run this once a month, and our next bone health group will be the first Wednesday of June, and I'm having a dietitian come that works here at the Moores Cancer Center come to talk to us. She's an expert in calcium, vitamin D, diet, and so she will be coming to us then to give a talk specifically geared to that. We do many talks at this group, and feel free to come. We talked last month, one of the specialists talked about bone density scans to explain what they mean, you know, in general, the T-scores, and get into the nitty-gritty on that. We've had our bone densitometrist, Diane Claflin, here at UCSD come and give us a talk about that as well a year ago. I have the orthopedic group come to talk about fractures, and we have all different, Dr. Diane Schneider here in our community has come to talk about vitamin D and calcium on multiple occasions. She comes and brings her containers of food and give a nice talk. So if you want, please come, and please feel free to send me an email, because I do have a listserv and an email list. So if you jot down my email, hhofflick@ucsd.edu, I can put you on this listserv and come throughout the year during the lunchtime and give you more information on that. So I know, I really thank you, and I thank you for the invitation to be here tonight. And I know I touched very briefly on a lot of things, and I'm happy to just stay and discuss more in detail, but I encourage you to ask any questions. So thank you. So the question is, Prolia, denosumab, one of the newer medicines, you may get an increase in bone density, but is it a true bone growth, is what you're asking. And so to answer that question first, is that actually, that's a very good question, and that just came up in the meeting. We are seeing these nice increases on that medication in spine bone mineral density, and we see that also in that other group, the bisphosphonates. We could see nice increases in bone mineral density, but is that true bone formation? And the answer is typically no. It is not with those medications. The only medication we have that truly builds back the bone is that teriparatide, or Forteo, the once daily injection, and hopefully that new drug I just talked about. So what happens, what I'm seeing when I take the people off bisphosphonates, and you see the bone density may stabilize, but it also tends to go down over time. Bisphosphonates, Fosamax, they maintain the bone structure and make it stronger and strengthen, but they don't build new bone necessarily. So these bone density increases we're seeing, you know, it's hard to say. Now with Prolia, it's very interesting, and I think we still have a lot to learn. Are we seeing true increases, or is it, you know, is it new bone growth? But I think we still have a lot to learn with that medicine, and we are learning. So the reclast is the trade name. So zoledronic acid is a bisphosphonate. It is inhibits the breakdown of bone. It's in the same as Fosamax and Actonel and Alendronate, you know, all those names, Alendronate. And it is a once yearly infusion. So it works differently in that it's given through the vein instead of taken from the oral route. So that is the difference. So it has different side effects. Right, so the question is, are there any studies saying how long can you use Forteo more? Can we use it longer? So Forteo or teriparatide, the daily injections that build back the bone, is currently only FDA approved for 2 years. I only use it for 2 years because of that. There are the concerns that after 2 years, there was this increase in bone cancer or osteosarcoma found in the rats, and thus that's why the study, you know, stops at 2 years, and that's why we do. That being said, when I go to my conferences, and off the record, are there people using it for longer? Are there studies? And there are studies that are trying to look, can it be used longer? But I do not recommend, my recommendation based on my knowledge, my studies, and the FDA approval is I do not go beyond 2 years of therapy.
What about rotating it by going back and forth?
Right. So there are studies looking at using it. So the question is, can you rotate it? Can you go back and forth? So there are studies that have looked at using it once a week, once a month, and different studies. But right now, the best benefit and the best fracture reduction shows daily use. And so if somebody has stopped it, if someone comes to me and they did a year of therapy, they stopped it, and can I go back and give them the extra year? Yes, surely. I will go back and give another year, but I will not go beyond that. So I think at this time, while there are studies looking at different patterns of use, I currently think the recommendation is not to use it beyond that or to use it in patterns, because the data really shows using it as daily, and that's where the fracture data lies, and that's the data that we know. So the question is, how accurate are the heel bone densities or ultrasounds, or some people also get, I'm going to add to that, the quantitative CAT scans that people might have heard about, CT scans. How accurate are those compared to bone density? So there is a lot of great literature, and I know some great studies done here at UCSD, really looking at that. Can we do an ultrasound with the heel, and some have compared very nicely in the studies to the current DEXA, the bone density scan, the way we know it. I will say right now, I would not base any of my recommendations or treatments for anything based on any other study but a bone density scan, as that is where we are now. The DEXA is the current scan that I use, and I know based on studies, based on evidence, to use it, to say that someone has it. My other concern is that I see a lot of people, they come to me with their quantitative CAT scans, that while that is a great indicator, it's more volumetric, it can get more of a qualitative, I talked about those things that make up the bone density. It may give me more information, but I'm not, still will not base my bone density recommendations on that, since all the criteria, the studies that were developed, the fractures were based on the X-ray bone density test, the DEXA scan. I also am concerned with the quantitative CTs, and now that we've learned over the last few years that CAT scans have a lot of radiation. So I don't encourage people to get these often, if, you know, maybe once to look, but I don't recommend these in general. I don't prescribe them. They may have them, and I am concerned about the long-term effects of radiation, the higher doses of radiation with a CT scan for those. Well, thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you for your time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.